What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of This Is Hot Boga. We're going to take a time to just kind of thank some of our sponsors that helped make this happen.
Next up is Hill People Gear. We're going to be rocking their new Decker Packs. Carries weight well. It was designed and created in the backcountry, not in some design studio. If you're looking for rugged, dependable backcountry gear, check out hillpeoplegear.com.
So another company we'd like to thank is Styrka Optics. They've been a longtime sponsor of the show, and we're very thankful for them. They continue to have elite products out there in the industry, and if you're looking for a new set of binos or a spotting scope, you need to check these guys out. Our RK1s from Newbury Archery really made it easier for me and James to be adaptable to the traditional world. These custom bolts were made exactly for us and how we wanted them. I got mine dipped in ASAT, and it's absolutely beautiful. Check it out.
Because they do custom dipping and stuff too. Bowworks and Kyle and all those guys do a great job with that.
Newbreedarchery.com.
We care about the world that we live in and the world that we hunt in. So we love companies that really work hard to preserve the land that we hunt. One of these companies is United by Blue. One of their initiatives is that they will clean up a pound of trash out of your waterways for every purchase that you make there. And it gets even better. You can enter promo code HOTBOGA in, save yourself 10%, buy some fantastic gear for hiking, for everyday wear, and you can do good for the environment. Go to unitedbyblue.com, buy yourself some dandy threads.
So Northern Broadheads just sent us some of their brand new barefoot shafts, and I can't tell you how sweet they are. I just had them bare shafted at Long Range Archery here in Holland, Michigan, and I am shooting straighter than I ever have. If you want to get some of these shafts, head over to their website, save yourself some money, use the promo code HOTBOGA and save yourself 10%.
Well, what, do you want to jump right into it?
Sure, yeah, let's go for it.
Thanks for coming on. You want to tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into it?
Yeah, I am Ray Kosydar. It's a crazy last name, Kosydar. I started Pacific Giants on Instagram and Facebook and a YouTube channel called Pacific Giant Productions on YouTube. Yeah, kind of throwing, dabbling in the waters out there just to see what it's like.
How do you like it so far?
I get to meet a lot of great people. If that's all I get out of it, I'm actually happy with that. So I'm actually going to have some probably lifetime friendships out of the whole ordeal. So
yeah, that's the sweet thing about hunting. Mm-hmm. Out in Washington, right?
Oh, Oregon.
Oregon, okay. Yep. How long have you been out there?
Never left. 42 really? Years. Yeah.
Interesting. So, are you on the coast? Or are you inland, or where are you?
I grew up in the central Oregon coast. I mean, like right on the beach. And then as soon as I graduated, you know, of course you have to move away. So I moved away.
Yeah.
Just a few weeks after graduation, my senior year, and then I'm out in the valley, which is you got the coastal range, mountain range, and then the valley, and then you got the Cascades. Which Cascades are, you know, quite a bit bigger mountain.
Right. Hmm.
And so the valley's just right in between. There's a lot more work, a lot more people. I'm a plumbing contractor, and so there's plenty of work here. Not so much on the coast.
So does that mean you've done any clam digging out there?
I'm a third generation clam digger is how I put it. So
you're going for razors, right?
Yep, razor clams. I don't like the bay clams as much. Yeah. They stink. They smell like poop. And the ocean, I'm right on the ocean. So right on the Pacific Ocean. Actually, I like going out in the ocean, knee deep to, and you're wearing chest waders, of course. Right. It's really cold water. So, and actually gathering my limit out in the surf. So
do you typically do that in the morning then, right when the tide's going back out?
It depends on the tide. Yeah, sometimes there's a low tide in the evening. It's whenever the low tide is. You got to hit it
just right.
So I like to hunt on the way out with the tide, and then sometimes I don't dig any of them until I could see them, and then I could dig the bigger ones. And then that sometimes usually waits until slack low, and then the tide starts coming in, and then they start necking, and then actually in Oregon, if you dig it, you got to keep it.
Right.
So if you don't know what you're digging and you end up getting a 2-inch clam, that's you only get 15 of them. So you have to keep it. So
that's 15 per person then?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So it's, I want to know what I'm digging before I dig it, so I could high grade is what we call it. Pick
trophy
the biggest
hunting.
Ones.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm spotting stocking.
That's right.
I spot and stock and dig. So I still use a shovel. A lot of guys use the clam guns.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm still more traditional. It's I'm pretty fast at it, and so it's a lot of fun. I'm actually going to try to invite a couple people that aren't familiar with digging or haven't dug or been out and never dug one and teach them how to dig this year on, like, I'll probably do some sort of a giveaway on Instagram or something like that.
That's a good idea.
Are you willing to fly people out?
Yeah. Right.
Cause I'll join that giveaway.
That's right.
It's a long ways for 15 clams, but yeah. If you want to fork out the money, I can't afford that, but the come out to Oregon, I'll definitely take you out clam digging. Last year was the first year I've ever taken off time from work just to go clam digging. I just kind of was playing around with Instagram with it, and it actually turned out pretty nice. A lot of people interested in coming out and learning. So I was kind of taking it like I was going extreme. So I was like, okay, I'm scouting. So literally I go there to scout my location.
Right.
Yeah. So I was going into a spot I didn't normally clam dig. The spot that I normally did, there was some bacteria growing. So they call it like a red tide.
Yeah.
And
they had it
closed down south where I normally dig, but up north was wide open. So I drove my trailer up there, and I asked, my dad's retired, and I was like, come on, dad, let's go dig. And that wasn't too hard to convince him to do it. And yeah, we went up there, and I think we dug for 3 days. And so it was kind of fun. We scouted for elk during when the tides, you know, after we were done digging. And I think we pretty much just kind of hung out. It was kind of fun hanging out with my dad like that.
Pacific Giants. That's some sort of salamander. Is that right?
It is.
Okay. Why did you guys pick that?
It's they like to live in the swamps, and they actually, they're, I don't know what the technical name is, but they change. So they start out with gills and living in the water, and then they move out of the water to land, and then they lose their gills and start breathing oxygen. So that's pretty much how we hunt. We're hunting in the swamps and mud and wet. And if we had gills, we'd probably hunt a lot better.
So you would fit really well in West Michigan, or at least where we hunt. Jared's basically his own version of a Pacific giant. You're a Pacific giant, Jared.
Right around the rut.
Yeah. Yep. A lot of swimming and hip waders, and
I get a swollen
smelly
neck
mud. And... Yeah, he gets all rutted up too. It's gross.
start rolling in the mud.
Yeah. We go in deep. So tell me a little bit about your approach. And we're gonna get into some of the gutless method stuff in a minute, but I would assume your style of hunting in Oregon is much different than it would be somewhere on the Rockies where there's a lot more open space. Is that about right?
Yeah, my style of hunting is different from everybody that hunts, period. I mean, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Born and Raised or the Jason Phelps, Phelps game calls. You know, they're the cat road shuffle. They like to call, walk, call, walk, call, walk, and then finally find a bull that wants to play along with them.
Yeah.
And they're really good at it. They do really good. And I don't have the luxury of going places where, you know, like I can't go some of the areas I'm hunting. There's no way to just start sit there and call in each basin. There's so many different landowners, and you got to know what's open and what's closed, what's walk in, what's, you know, you could drive in some you could ride a bike, you know, some you can't.
Right.
So you got to have all these different rules, and, you know, having a mapping system that tells you what property owner you're on and knowing what's open. That's, so I've got some of the national forests, they're just like squares, and, each square, you know, it's like, it's a checkerboard. So that's national forest, but the next one is private timber company, which is one company, and the next one's a different, you know, national forest, and then another private timber company. So if I was to sit there and call, you know, I'm going to call when it's going to be in closed land, and then it's that's not going to be very fun. So the way I hunt is kind of spot and stalk. That's like my all, you know, that's like my favorite, but that doesn't always work on the coast because it's so brushy. So I usually just kind of set up ambush points to you know, I kind of know where the elk are at, I pattern them out, And whether hunters, you know, because I'm hunting with everybody else, it right. all plays out, you know. You never know. And I think that's kind of the exciting part. So sometimes you'll just be walking and they'll be bugling, or you can hear some cows, you know, talking, or some branches popping or whatever. And then I'll just work the wind and decide if it's worth to go in now or to back away and come back at a better time where they're coming the direction I want them to come away, you know, to get more into the land that's open away from the closed land. Sometimes, you know, it's just every scenario is a little different. I still like calling. I think that, you know, bugling one in or cow calling and getting a response back and getting the herd bull to come to you, there's nothing else like it. Joe tries to tell me it's like turkey hunting, but
yeah,
I say BS on that.
Do you guys have turkey out there?
We do. We've got a few turkeys here in the valley. Southern Oregon's loaded with turkeys. And Eastern Oregon, there's some spots. I think I want to say like 18 birds per mile or some. They're quite a bit over there.
Yeah.
I just don't have any desire to hunt them.
Should not tell Joe that. Mm-hmm. Joe.
I know. Yeah. I know. I mean, now, if Joe invited me over and we were going to swap a hunt, I go to hunt with him turkeys and he comes out and elk hunts with me. Maybe we'll work something out like that.
But I think if I was just to go the better end of that deal.
Yeah, and he's killed hundreds of turkeys too. So yeah, so I think it'd be fun. But he's, you know, we've talked about it, and he goes, it's kind of like elk hunting. It's one day's good, and the next day's not. And I said, absolutely. So
yeah, I see people. We've talked about this before. They're similar in that you have to, like, at least the way we do it is more mobile, rather than you're deer stand. You're just sitting in a deer stand. And so, yeah, I would say that it's similar in that nature, but, you know, I would say elk hunting is way more physical.
It is. The elk are always in the worst locations, it seems like, you know. Yeah. They're usually at the bottom, and they're usually the roads are at the top. So you could drive the roads at the top, and then there's elk are at the bottoms. But if there's a road at the bottom, there probably wouldn't be elk at the bottom. They'd be at the top. So, yeah, so that's... They're big, so once you get one down, you know, it's all hands on deck. It's get that meat out, get the cape off it, cool it down, and start packing. And sometimes it's not, you know, I've packed so, you know, elk out so far that you don't even sleep. You just take a shower, change your camo, and you're out hunting the next morning. So it's, you know, you packed all night and you're just whooped. I mean, it's just, I try to keep my packs under 100 pounds because I could pack more. I'm better. I'm going to hurt myself if I go more. I could pack more in certain applications. But if you're going down through, you know, the jungle and stuff, and all it takes is stepping on a log and you're sideswiped and then you're hurting yourself, you know, and that's not going to be a good scenario.
No.
So sometimes, you know, 75, like a hind quarter on an elk is with a bone in it. The bone's going to be about six to eight pounds of bone in the hind quarter, and I'll pack the bone out because I like having that meat and on the bone.
You do roast or do you use to make broth out of the bones, or what do you do with them?
No, it just so like when you cut a hind quarter, the only spot that's exposed to the air that you've cut through the meat is right there at the hip socket. So like I separate the hip, so that piece of meat right there will get like nasty, crusty, dried. It'll turn like deep purple, and and then you could just take a flay knife and then just cut that, and it's probably, I don't know, maybe 6 inches around of just nasty gross meat, and you could just take a flay and just cut, you know, slice through that, so you're only wasting that little chunk of meat. So every time you cut into the meat, it's going to dry out, and it doesn't have that silver skin on it.
Yeah, it's got that like hard,
it'll develop that little rind on there.
Yeah,
rind.
Exactly. Yep. And so the least, if you were to separate the bone, take it out, every piece of meat's going to have that same texture. You know, it's going to have all them cut marks from your knife going around. So I want to keep the shoulders attached to the, you know, the scapulas, and the hindquarters attached to the bone. And then everything else pretty much is deboned. So there's four quarters, and then everything else is going to get deboned.
You guys got a pretty slick gutless processing method.
This gutless plus, right? Is that what you call it?
Yeah. I nicknamed it Gutless Plus because I still gut them. I started it in 2009 was the first time Ray Werdinger showed me how to do the gutless method. Mm-hmm. And I was like, dude, this is just a game changer. It cut me down 4 or 5 fold in time. And it's so much cleaner because the meat does not touch anything but the inside of a meat bag. So like I'll lift the front shoulder up. If I'm by myself, it's a little bit harder, but I'll have to lift it up and I'll have the bag ready on the ribs. And then I'll just set the shoulder down on top of the bag. And then I just, they look like giant condoms. They're just a caribou, like a cheesecloth, but they're just, they're rolled out like a condom.
Your condoms don't want to be like cheesecloth though.
Yeah. And then I just roll them out, you know, and then tie a knot so the flies don't blow.
Right.
And then if I can hang them from a tree, that's so you get air circulation all the way around. Mm-hmm. If not, I just fold, like the first ones I usually do is the front shoulders. So I take out the front shoulder, I set it down, and then my hind quarter on that same side is my next piece of meat I'm going to pull off. And then when I get that one bagged, I set it down, but then I roll my front shoulder. So now it's not trapping the heat between the meat and the ground. So right. I've actually rolled it into a new fresh spot, preferably up on branches and sticks and stuff. And then it's just a process of getting the backstrap, neck roast. I still cut all the ribs meat out with the gut still in it. I don't touch the only piece of meat I don't take is that little piece that holds the guts in. So if you open that up, then the guts fall out. So I just leave that one side. So when I'm done and that piece of meat, I'm ready to roll over to start caping the other side. There's nothing left to take. I mean, it's all meat. I don't bother taking the tenderloin through the front loins out until I roll over. And then right. I take all the cape off that. Same thing. Front shoulders first. I set that out. And as I set that one down, I roll that hind quarter back over onto a new side. So it's starting to cool. And then that front shoulder roll, the first one I did, I roll again. And then I basically, hind quarter, back straps. I take the back straps, they stay in their own bag. So back strap is its own bag. I want that back strap to cool down evenly. The hamburger, I don't really care about. The hamburger goes all in one bag, and it's about 80 to 100 pounds of burger. And it doesn't cool down. When you have a bag that thick, it'll hold heat for quite a while.
Yeah.
But I'm grinding it, and I don't think it hurts the flavor, but the steaks, it definitely changes the flavor because you're trapping that heat in there. So very end, I don't take the rib meat out on the second side. I have everything else ready to go. And then I just open it up and I don't really gut it. I just open it up, move the guts to the brisket.
Yep.
And then, at that point now the cavity's not poking out through the ribs with the gut. Right. And then I could debone all the ribs without having to worry about the guts. Mm-hmm. And then I could see taking out the tenderloins, the front loins on these big Roosevelts. We get these big chunks of meat. They're probably, I'd say about the size of a whitetail tenderloin. They're about that size. So it's a nice chunk of meat.
Yeah.
That most guys just leave because they're doing the other gutless method. And then I take the heart and liver out.
That was going to be my question. Heart.
Heart is awesome. Liver is the nastiest thing. I don't mind like looking and touching it, but like the smell of it cooking, I can't.
Yeah,
I can't be
that's
an hard
for me too. Yep,
it's nasty. I mean, I can't. A gallon of ketchup, maybe I can eat some, but that's yeah. I use it for Dungeness crabbing, crawdad. Do crawdad trap with some liver in it, and I don't let it soak out. Normally, I let it soak. If we're going for human consumption, I'll put it in some salt water and.
Okay.
Then let it salt out, you know, clean itself. But if I'm just going to use it for crab bait, I'm chunking the thing up and keeping as much blood in that thing as possible. And man, I tell you what, the Dungeness crab, we just used up the last of my liver stock in my freezer from Dungeness. We caught 47, I think, my wife and kids and I. We were one short. My daughter dropped the one. So we had our limit. She just dropped it into the water on accident. But it pinched her pretty good, so she kind of freaked out. So
you're using pretty much all parts of this whatever elk, cow, or bull that you get. You're getting the heart.
Yeah.
You're getting the liver, even though you don't like it. Is there any part that you're unable to take, or it sounds like you really get everything with this this gutless plus method?
I like neck roast, like with the bone in. And if I was close enough, I'd take the saw and just saw its neck off, and then I could make three neck roasts out of that bone in. You're going to get a lot more meat off the bones. The neck is really, really hard to get all the meat off. I mean,
yeah, I agree.
You still get the big chunks, but there's a lot of little pieces of meat. Like when you're making a roast, it just falls off the bones at that point.
Well, it's weird for us because I like the neck roast with bone in. You know, like you said, you can just, I mean, at the end, if you roast, like slow cook it, you just have like a little white bone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's off, but
everything's off.
We have like CWD in the area.
Oh yeah.
Yep. And it makes me worried. Is that how CWD passes? It's through the stem, right? So I think, I don't know. Like Laura does not like me. My wife's like, I don't know how I feel about having like bone in neck roast for that reason.
I've never even heard. I don't even think we have that in Oregon.
Yeah.
Not yet.
It's chronic wasting disease. So it's in our deer. And I think it's in our county. Right,
yeah,
Jared?
It is. It's in Kent County now.
Which we do some hunting in Kent, and then we do some north and some east. But for a while it was CWD, then it was EHD, but now I feel like you're seeing a lot more or hearing about CWD now. So all I know is it's like connected with the brain. So I don't know if it passes that way or not. I feel like there's a lot of tests done that aren't so conclusive one way or the other. So I just haven't been avoiding it lately, which you feel bad because with that bone in, it's so good. So good to eat.
It is. Yeah. And then like the pressure cooker or that new, my wife got that new one. I don't even know what it's called. But it's, the bone in, that's weird how, I've never even heard of having that disease. I mean, I've heard of like deer around here with a hair loss disease, but I don't think that's the same. And then we have some liver, some different stuff with liver on our deer that, it's noticeable little white bumps, I guess, on the livers. But
you know, I thought there was something about one of those diseases for us with liver. You could, was that EHD? I don't know. No, I feel like I should know this.
I know. I think I'd be calling the state if I did kill one and the liver was all jacked up.
Oh, for sure.
I'd be like, I'd still take all the meat and pack it out, and then I'd contact the state.
Yep.
Say, hey, what's up with this? Is this human consumption or is this all crawdad bait, you know?
What they're doing by us now is you bring it in, they test it for free, and then they give you like a little report on the deer. So my dad shot a, like this, he shot it, and he thought it was a doe because it was huge. He's like, it's the biggest deer probably that he's ever seen body. He gets to it, and it has these like 2-inch antlers that are pointed like straight forward and like kind of curved over.
Almost like the size of a thumb or something.
Yeah. Thumb size.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what he did with the skull. So he's like, that is weird. And it wasn't anything like disease or anything. He's like, that's just weird. So I said, you should have it tested either way. You're in a county. So he had it taken in and it was like a 6-year-old buck.
I thought it was a doe.
No, it was a 6-year-old buck, but it was just it got all jacked up head or something. and it grew just for it. He's got like the little report saved.
Wow.
But it was old and it dressed out at how much? It was a huge, he's like, it's the biggest deer he had ever seen, but it was this weird. So he brought it in. He got a test. It was fine. We ate it. Laura said she didn't want to eat it.
She didn't want any of it.
You know what? She ate it anyways. When it's cooked, you get the loins all.
Sneak it in there.
Yeah. You know, it's not going to hurt anybody.
Huh. Yeah. That's weird. I know, coming from state to state, coming into Oregon and stuff, you know, you have to check your animals and stuff, I guess, and no blood. I don't know. I don't hunt out of state, so I'm just kind of, it's all hearsay, but it seems like you have to do this, the check your animal in with Fish and Wildlife and they check it. I don't know what they're checking. I think it's for that chronic wasting disease.
Or
CSD. Yeah. So
CWD. Yeah. We used to get patches. Didn't they used to get patches out, Jared?
No, they still give those out. If you're a successful hunter and you take it.
I need to get
in,
a patch. I've never got one.
They you know, that they'll age the deer, you know, that by putting, you know, checking the teeth. And then they'll give you a successful hunter patch.
I need one of those. Yeah. Do they do turkeys?
They do turkeys. You don't have to be a successful hunter for that. So you can buy one for $5 to the DNR.
So you have to buy one to get one if you want to just make yourself feel good.
Yes.
But
everyone gets a trophy. Everyone gets a trophy during turkey hunting.
If you are successful, do you get one?
You got to let me know what state this is. Is this Wisconsin? Which one is it? What is it?
The Michigan, the mitten.
Michigan?
Yeah.
I might just have to do that just to have a patch of this.
That's what I'm saying. $5. I'm for sure getting one this year. Yeah, throw it on my pack.
They're different every year, and they've all got their, like, the 2018,
why aren't we getting
2019.
These? We got to get one for deer, too. I'm putting them
I'm
on my
only
pack.
Getting one if I'm successful.
Obviously. I'm not – this is not a participation.
I'm not a cheater.
Yeah, no.
Oh, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to buy them just to have one. That sounds cool.
They are
nothing like that in Oregon.
You know,
that's awesome.
That's how they trick you into getting your deer test. It's not a trick. It's just an incentive.
Here's a
patch. It's a good incentive. Yeah.
Come on in.
So,
okay.
I was looking at some of your pictures and videos and stuff, and so I also noticed a thing. You cut up your deer in an interesting way, and it sounds like a really, really great way.
Elk.
All right, you do deer that way, too.
It's a big deer.
Yeah.
An ungulate.
And I noticed that you rock what those are, wilderness packs. And it looks like you like take everything off, bag and everything. I'd assume that's just to keep your bags clean. How does that work?
Yes. So I carry two packs. I have my pack board, which is the same pack board as on my pack. I could pack. I don't want to have to clean my packs. I've ruined packs from packing meat and it just smells, and you can't, some of the times you can't get that blood out. And I've soaked them. I put them in a washing machine. I know you're not supposed to. I've put them in drums, soaked them with I've tried everything and I can't get the smell out.
Yeah.
So I just, from now, I think 2000. So I bought the Wilderness Pack. I bought in 2009, right after elk season.
Mm-hmm.
My buddy shot, I called in this giant 6x5. And when I mean giant, this thing's like at the time of score, it was like the 10th largest non-typical Roosevelt ever scored.
Really?
And I knew it was giant, but he's only like 3 feet high. He's like really short, but just super massive, long time. And he's a 5-point frame. He just has one extra point down at the base. So he's got three brow tines on one side. So he's a 5-frame. So just, it's a freak. I mean, and I knew he was a giant. And we were after him in a 7-point that year. And they were kind of in the same area fighting for the same cows. And he had the pack board. And my buddy Ray Werdinger, he had a pack board. So Mike Preston and Ray Werdinger are my hunting partners. And I brought them into my area to, Mike, I've been hunting with him since, I think he's been hunting for like 5 or 6 years, unsuccessful. I was like, I brought him in as a greenhorn, and I think he's killed 3 or 4 elk now, and that one being the biggest, of course. That one's a giant. But he's like, puts on a hind quarter, and these hind quarters on this bull are probably 125. I didn't actually weigh him, but I know I know what a 100-pound hind quarter looks like, and 125, and this one was right there with the 125 range. He puts it on there. I got it strung over my shoulder on my stupid pack.
Yeah,
and I'm like, never again. And I'm cussing because I can't. We're it's super foggy. We can't see where we're going. The headlamp it magnifies. It's like all fog crystal. Fog
just
blows up.
Exactly what you're talking about. Yep.
You can't see only 20 feet in front of you because it's so foggy, and it's just you're blinded by the fog refracting back to your eyes, and then. And then we're doing circles. Literally, we had to go back on the blood trail. And it was him, my dad, and I, and you could just see three headlamps running around in the woods trying to find back to the rig. It wasn't all that far to pack, but here I've got this stupid thing. Mike's, hands are free. I've got meat in my pack and I'm holding it because it's uncomfortable. I'm holding the leg. And then I get back on the blood and I walk the blood back. And and that gave me a direction. And then I could walk from there. I could find the back to the rig, and I was like, this is stupid. And I was frustrated because you probably just walk 5 times farther than you really needed to. And when you got that much weight on your back, it's not comfortable, in a horrible pack. It wasn't the pack's fault. I was using a different pack manufacturer. I won't mention it because I don't want to give them any bad publicity. I love their packs. They're great packs. It wasn't the Wilderness. It was a pack that I was using before Wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
You can just say it. We'll just cut it out.
We'll bleep it. A big long bleep.
It was not a. it wasn't a meat packing pack. It was a right. day pack, you know, to pack your gear around. And so I get back to the rig, and luckily I had a flashlight in the rig. I hung it on the way back. I hung it in a tree to shine back towards where the elk is at. And this is like 2 a.m. at this time.
Right,
and,
of course.
And my mom, she's like, she's at the elk still by herself out in the woods, no weapons. And then we all left her, and then we yell, turn the light on. And she takes the flashlight and shines it straight up in the air like a, one of them, you know,
like the back call.
Yeah, exactly. So we have an aiming point. So, and then I have that light shining in the tree back towards her. So the next loads were much easier, but still what a pain. And Mike's just like, I'm like, man, that's so much more comfortable looking. So that was done. That was 2009. Yeah. And by 10, bought it right after that. Bought my dad one and myself one. And I think since 2010, I've packed out 12 Roosevelt bulls on my pack.
Wow.
And it's the same one. It's going strong. I mean, and I soak them after they're all bloody and stuff. I soak them in hot water, and then I let them, and then I put that scent stuff on there, and then let them drip out, and then get all the blood out of the straps, the buckles, the pack. You know, there's only nylon and plastic, so they're really easy to clean. But I want to say he got a new rating on them. He had them tested out to like 200 pounds, I think, wilderness pack for that same bighorn pack frame. I've put on some weight on there. I don't know if I've ever put 200 pounds on one, but I know I was well over 150 on a pack with a couple quarters, you know, elk quarters. Cause it's like, I can get this elk out in two packs, you know, type thing.
Right.
And being stupid. Now it's just dumb. I mean, young, you know, being a lot stronger and younger, I guess. Now it's like, oh, I'll be safe, put 75 to 100 pounds and make, you know, 3 or 4 packs.
Right.
So we
just
yield
a few extra miles, but you're saving your back in the long run.
The old knees too.
Yeah. And it's safer. You know, if you fall and stab yourself with a stick or slide and break your leg, you know, then you're screwed. So, and these bulls were getting 400 pounds of edible meat off of a decent Roosevelt, nothing huge. So they're good sized animals. And that's, you know, that's no bones. That's like processed meat. So, you know, with the bones in it, you're probably looking at 12 to 18 pounds of bones in the hindquarters, and then the scapula. I don't know what the next bone is. The fibia, maybe. I don't know what
I failed that class.
Yeah, me too.
It sounded right.
Yeah.
Not that much weight on an elk. So, and plus it makes the meat better to, you know, we have a walk-in cooler, hang the meat, and it stays in there for at least a week. And I don't think that's necessary. It just gives us time to debone it and cut it up on our schedule, not weather or, you know, so we're over hunting. That's what we want to do.
Right.
We might be tagged out, but we want to be calling or packing for somebody else. And so it just makes it nicer. We put that in 2009, I think was our, cause that was my buddy 6x5. That was our first bull that we put into that cooler. And I think now we're probably like 65 different animals that we've put in that cooler since then.
Sheesh.
I have beef, so we do our own beef. Mm-hmm. I hang our beef in there. Beef, you definitely want to hang. I've started tenderizing all our steak with the Cuber tenderizer, even a backstrap. I've tenderized the backstrap. I don't think you need to hang them all that long, but it's just, like I said, it's a convenience factor for us. Like, we'll shoot it on a weekend, go back to work all week, go back the next weekend with the cooler, pull out a hind quarter, debone it, put the meat, you know, in a tray. Next day, do a front shoulder, you know, put the meat in the tray, and then start separating hamburger and steaks, and then get all, once it's all done, then break it out, start grinding and cutting all the steaks into actual steaks and tenderize it.
Before we move on, I wanted to take a minute to thank one of our show sponsors, Pelican Coolers. These coolers are extremely tough and backed by a lifetime warranty. But what I like most about our coolers is that, as tough as they are, they can be opened with the push of a button. So it'll keep the bears out, but you won't have any trouble getting in. And it gets even better. Right now, if you type in pelicancoolers.com/hotboga, you'll get a free tumbler with the purchase of any cooler. And we all use the 32-ounce tumbler, and it does an amazing job at keeping hot drinks hot for a very long time and cold drinks cold for a very long time. I'm going to do something maybe a bit unusual or something that I haven't done yet, but I'm going to throw out a James D. guarantee, which is something I don't just toss around willy-nilly. I'm going to James D. guarantee that if you buy one of these coolers, you'll have the best cooler experience you've ever had, and you'll be changed as a person for the better. Your life will be totally different from here on out. So don't take my word for it. Go check them out for yourself, pelicancoolers.com/hotboga. And now, back to our show. So, Ray, how long have you been doing this? How long have you been elk hunting? You mentioned you grew up in Oregon. Is this like you were a little kid? You know, I know you mentioned before you were a third generation clam digger. Are you also a third generation elk hunter?
I am, and it's not what you think. it's my mom's mom. So my grandma Elma, she is the elk hunter, and then of course really? My mom's elk hunter. My dad got introduced to elk hunting through my mom's mom, his mother-in-law. So I'm still third generation through my mom's side.
You're the first one. Everybody on our podcast usually is introduced by their dad. You got to be the first introduced by your grandma guest we've had. Should we send him like a medal or something for that?
You get a patch.
Yep, you get a patch.
I get a patch, a grandma patch. I'll take it. So in the area that my dad grew up was all deer and fishing. There was no elk. He said that when they introduced the elk in the 70s, in that area, he was in high school, and he remembers everybody in high school heard a logger had seen an elk, or it was somewhere. Okay. The whole town went out to go look at this elk because it was the first elk, bull
That's
elk
so crazy.
Ever got to see. So, and it's funny because that time now, I mean, it's just, I mean, you see them all over the place. It's just
that would be what it would be like though in Michigan. So they introduced elk not that long ago in here back in Michigan, reintroduced, I guess you could say. But if I were to know that there was an elk, my whole family would go see it. You know, there's a spot in Michigan where they are sometimes, and we've like wanted to, you know, that's a destination in itself just because it's so rare to see them.
Yeah, I mean their primary habitat right now is in the northern part,
like
kind of
like the middle knuckle for the middle finger.
Yes,
finger, right?
The northern part of the lower peninsula.
Yeah. Yes.
So, and those are those Roosevelt descendants, or did they move them from a Rocky Mountain location?
They're Rocky Mountain.
They're Rockies.
Are they? Because there's some giant ones. I've seen those Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Pennsylvania, Kentucky does.
Yeah, Kentucky. Yeah. So I've seen some of those bulls come out of there because it's only like 10 tags or something in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
But they're giant. It's like totally reminds me of a Roosevelt because their bodies look just big. I don't know. Maybe it's a feed. It could be the feed, but they're, you know, there's some big bulls. I was like, dang, I should put in for that Pennsylvania one. But in my luck, I'd draw it, and then I'd be like trying to convince my wife, hey, honey, I'm going to be gone for 3 weeks to Pennsylvania to go hunt elk when I got the same ones in my backyard, you know. So
yeah, but it's, you know, are you putting in, Jared?
I have been putting in points. Yeah,
I do too. I've hopefully one time in my life I will get to shoot an elk in Michigan.
A Michigan elk.
That'd be amazing. Maybe when I get older, they're going to be, like you said, you know, all over the place like they are in Oregon.
Yeah. And it's, there were some elk on the coast in different parts, but they got shot out and poached. So when they reintroduced them, there was a lot of poaching going on, shooting elk. And so, which is just stupid. I mean, now I wish people like where you guys are reintroducing the elk. You know, I wish they could talk, you know, the poachers, just like, look, just, you know, not even one generation. And there's like my dad from high school only seeing one elk in the high school to almost filling his tag out every year. We're passing up, you know, several bulls to get to the one he wants. Not anymore. He's actually shooting. He goes, I'm shooting the first legal bull I see because he's like, he's 69 years old and bad back. His vertebrae are all fused together. So it's big creature when it hits the ground. So he doesn't care. He likes to, he likes to say the young ones eat better, but I don't believe it.
You know, I don't ever know what to believe, because I think that even if they did objectively taste better, the young ones than the old ones, I still think the old ones taste better because you know that you shot a giant at the end.
Yeah.
It's like, no, that's the monster rock that I shot.
Yeah, and you get, you know, lifetime on the wall. Yep. The meat's only going to last you a year. And
people
always say, oh, I hunt for the meat. I call BS. That's the worst. I hate when people say that. It's like, if you're, I could sell you my beef cow, come out and shoot my beef cow, and you get twice as much more meat off a beef cow than you are going to get elk.
Right.
And it didn't cost you anything, you know?
or even this scenario, say you're in the field and you've got two game animals out in front of you. It can be deer or elk.
What about bear? Can it be a bear?
I don't care.
Okay, turkey?
Bring it on, man. Whatever you dream these two animals to be.
I'm dreaming.
And there's two ducks swimming in a pond.
They're dreaming a Jake next to a Tom. And the weird thing about it is my brother's names are Jake and Tom. So I'm picturing a Jake next to a Tom.
Okay, a Jake and a Tom next to each other. Both have the same body size. Exact same body size.
Yeah.
One has antlers on them. We'll say
antlered turkey?
Sure. Okay. Like I said, whatever you want it to be.
All right. Yes.
All right. One, they have the same size body.
Mm-hmm.
One has antlers on them, probably, you know, but we'll say the size of your hand.
Sure.
Symmetrical, the size of your hand. Yes, a fork.
Yep.
The other is a giant antlered
animal. You have to say it the Western way. So it would be, if it's an 8-point for him, just so he understands what we're talking about, I'll translate for you. It's a 4x4 buck.
No, I'm going to go
with eye guards or without, because yeah, we count eye guards.
See, we count eye guards. So we'll say, so you're saying a fork compared to an 8-point or really a 3-point in Oregon, because you don't count.
Okay.
No, I want to go 6x6.
All right, 6 by 6, so a giant buck.
Or a bull. Or a horned turkey, you're talking. What would you take? If you're a meat hunter, you're shooting you don't care.
I don't know.
Yeah.
What would you shoot if you're purely hunting for meat?
A better scenario, though, is a smaller one with antlers and a bigger one without antlers.
One
would you take?
Because you have to decide from equal-sized animals, because most people would say, oh, so I don't care, I'm hunting for meat. To me, I would shoot the bigger one because I like having a bigger horned animal.
Yeah.
Okay, one more little spin to it.
Yeah.
The smaller one, equal body size, the smaller one has a perfect broadside, and the other bigger one has a quartering two.
I like that, too.
The dangerous quartering two. Did you take a quartering two shot on anything, Jared, with that recurve, the way you've been shooting lately? The lights out.
Oh, so you're recurving. Okay. So it's a quartering away on the big one, and perfect broadside, same distance. They're both standing there. One's, you know, getting flighty. He's about to run. The other one just standing there going,
I'll tell you what I would take.
That's a tough.
You're going to shoot the bigger one.
You're going to shoot the bigger one.
It's a safe shot.
That's why you practice.
They're both safe shots, quarter and away, or quarter and two. I'll take a quarter and two me shot on an elk. I don't know what it is on that shot. I don't like straight on. I've only shot one elk in my ever straight on, and he was wounded.
Yeah.
And it was 77 yards. I was actually watching the bull, and he was standing there at 77 yards. And then my buddy shot, but I didn't know he hit it. And I could hear his bow go off, and I was like 250 yards away.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bull ran straight at me and just stopped at 77. And I ranged it. I was ready to shoot. I had an arrow knocked. I'm not going to take that shot on a healthy elk at all. And,
right.
And then it was like,
getting that assist.
Yeah, exactly. So he's like, I got an arrow in him. And I was like, okay. So I just stood up, and I didn't care if the bull saw me or not. I'm going to shoot him. And
right.
I stood up and already knew my 70-yard pin right on the tip of his nose. He just straight. I mean, there was no quartering, nothing. It was straight on. And I buried it into his brisket all
right
the way
up to my
pin.
Yep.
And it actually sounded really bad. It was like a 2x4 getting smashed across a tree. It just went crack. And he ran with his back legs. And his front legs were pinned back, and he was just plowing the ground.
Mm.
And then he finally tripped over, fell up, and then he got up and he did that again and went behind a tree. And then Ray come up to me. He goes, "Man, you hit him!" And I couldn't see his arrow. You know, it was just So I just couldn't see it. And then we get up to him. Now, Bull's still alive. I mean, we didn't wait. He walked to me 250 yards, and then I walked around this tree, and that bull's still alive. So he's got the broadside, double lung shot on this bull. I've got an arrow straight down through the underneath the throat, going back towards the tenderloins, and he's just spewing out blood, and he's still there. So Ray grabs another arrow and puts a third arrow in him. It's like,
you're tough, man.
These Roosevelts are very tough animals. And
but going back to the scenario, you mentioned to say that it's just for the meat isn't maybe totally. I would agree that it's not totally accurate, but I'm not saying that it's not about the meat either.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when you're going out, it's about the adventure. I mean, it's about the meat. It's about shooting a mature animal that's difficult. It's a whole bunch of important things: time outside, time alone, time in the quiet, away from everything that goes on in the world and everyday life.
The discipline to your craft.
It's discipline. It's all the practice. You, and especially Jared and I know for all the really the practice we had to do because we've switched kind of our styles of shooting. All that kind of comes together, and it's like, yeah, I can't say that it's just for meat, at least for me, but
yeah,
it's part of it, certainly.
It's absolutely part of the deal. Once it's on the ground, that's all, I don't care nothing about, but preserving that meat and getting out, making it phenomenal. But to me, it's not about the meat. It's about everything out there, the excitement, the adrenaline rush, the time I get to spend with my mom, my dad, my grandma, my son I've been mentoring for the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's all, everything adds up. But I, like I said, I've got beef. If I wanted meat, I'd just shoot one of my cows and then have a full freezer. That doesn't do it for me, So when people say I hunt because of the meat, it's like, man, that's the most expensive meat you've ever bought. By the time you add up everything you've got invested in just for that one hunt, even if it was, if you were fortunate and you had to hunting elk or deer on your back property, which I know a lot of mid states and east states have that opportunity.
Yeah.
That makes more sense because you're not into it for much. Here, like I'm 2 hours away from where I elk hunt. So I've got to drive 2 hours.
Yeah.
And that's in archery season in Oregon, we have a month. So, and I like to pass up on, luckily I got my dad and my buddy Ray. They'll shoot pretty much anything. So we usually get two elk in the freezer, and then I'm like, okay, everybody, we split it regardless of who's there or not, or who helped pack or not.
Right.
We all split it, 25% each. Even though I got my son with me, we only take 25% because it's still my family. My mom and dad are their family. My hunting partner Ray and Mike, they all take 25. So if we get two elk, that's half an elk each, which is awesome. And we all put the hamburger together and make sausage and pepperoni.
It's a big family thing.
Yeah. So that's all, we divide that up later, but the steaks are all even, so many backstraps, so many, hindquarter steaks and so many front shoulder steaks and neck roast and everything else. But I get a high grade. So if we get two elk in there, I'm like, I'm high grading.
Of course.
I don't want to shoot a little bull. I'll shoot a little bull every year. But if we got two elk in the freezer, it's like, that's really hard to shoot a little elk when the big one's right there. And that big one, is going to give you a lot more meat. And I think it's the same quality meat as a little one, but you just get a lot more of it. And you get to look at the antlers for the rest of your life on the wall or in the barn it makes a better story, I guess. Nobody talks about the spike, the 17th spike they shot,
Yeah.
It was the biggest spike you've ever seen. It's a spike. But
yeah.
And they're not as smart, You get a herd of 70 elk and you got to take out the herd bull and get past all the spikes and the small branch bulls to get to that one, So it's calling. Sometimes you just draw in the little bulls. So it's trying to sneak in there without calling, get past, 140 eyes and 70 noses that could smell a mouse at 200 yards. So the challenge is so much, is there. But like my son, I tell my son, you're not in a position to pass up. If you shoot the first one that you want to shoot, then I'll be happy. Usually it's my tag, so he gets like during archery season, it's my tag. He tries to fill my archery tag for me. Yeah. It's called the mentor program. Mentor.
Yeah, I think we've got that here. Yeah.
You know, I said, you shoot whatever you want, you know, and I'll be happy to tag a fork and horn or a spike elk or something like that. That's no problem, you know.
Yeah.
Until you get to a position where you've passed, you know, you've shot enough spikes and now you're, okay, I want to get a mature bull, or I want that bull there, I want to get. And Andrew has had several opportunities on the herd bull. It's just, I told him, don't shoot unless you kill it. And that it's hard to take that as meaning everything's got to be right. And I said, if something doesn't feel right, then it's easy to not shoot. It sucks when you wound one. And I've been there and he'll be there. The more you hunt, the more chances, you know, every time you shoot, something could go wrong. And you hit a branch, your bow malfunction, you know, something, you hit your trigger a little early, something, you know.
Yeah.
So stuff happens and you know, and so like this year, we're in a herd of 50 cows. There was a little raggy five, and then the big herd bull was a five. And we end up getting between another herd. And so it was just chaotic, elk everywhere. The bull was at 11 yards and he had no shot. It was with the cows. He walked with the cows and then peeled off about broadside at 40. And my son's at full draw. And I'm trying to film and coach him, you know, say, okay, you know, he's asking me what yardage, and I tell him 40. He's got a 40-yard pin, but he's like, Dad, I don't feel comfortable shooting. And I'm like, then absolutely don't shoot, you know. And that made a successful season, in my opinion. We don't have to tag something. But to see your son, 13 years old, drawn back, or this year I guess he was 13 or 14 years old, drawn back on a mature bull, and where most people go 20 years without having that opportunity, it was I'm okay, I could close the season and be just happy.
That's what it's about. That would be awesome. Well, hey, Ray, we're coming up on time here, so I want to make sure we stay on time, but I appreciate you coming on the podcast. And I mean, we'd love to have you back. You got a wealth of knowledge, and it's all great. So where can people find you if they want to watch some of your information on the Gutless Plus method or any of the videos that you guys produce?
Facebook, Instagram is Pacific Giants, and then it'd be Pacific_Giants on Instagram. And then if you go to the YouTube, it's Pacific Giant Productions. And if you hit the subscribe button, that would be awesome. Apparently, you need like 1,000 subscribers to get paid to the ad source and stuff. So that's the threshold. I've been really pushing it for the last year, like 600 and some.
Okay.
That would be awesome if I could get some people to hit the subscribe button. And then comment on some of the videos. You know, I'm pretty open to suggestions. If I screwed up, let me know. Yep. If you like something, you know, down in the comments, if you need to get a hold of me, you know, say something on the comments. On Instagram, I'm pretty, you know, with the messenger. And I usually respond to when people are asking me if they're jerks. I don't usually respond. But if they got a sincere question, you know, with their kid, getting how to get them in hunting or how to get them involved in outdoors or fishing or whatever. Shoot me a text or email or message me. Usually respond pretty quick. So if anybody has any questions, let me know.
Cool. Well, thank you again for coming on. It's been great to talk, and we'll probably have some elk questions for you coming up pretty soon. So talk to you soon.
No doubt. If I don't talk to you guys I'm pretty sure I'll talk to you between now and then, but good luck this year. And if you need to call me, just let me know. And well, you got my cell, so give me a call if you got on a side note, you know, if you have any questions or anything like that.
I appreciate it. Will do.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.